Our scripture reading this evening is taken from the book of Proverbs and chapter 31. Proverbs chapter 31. The book of Proverbs consists of a number of sections, and this final chapter is essentially two independent compositions that have been joined together. The first part is verses 1 through 9 that speaks of the virtues of the king, the words of King Lemuel, and the second part from verse 10 through to verse 31 is independent and speaks of the good wife. But we look at them both together. Proverbs 31, the words of King Lemuel, the utterance which his mother taught him. What, my son, and what, son of my womb, and what, son of my bowels? Do not give your strength to women, nor your ways to that which destroys kings. It is not for kings, O Lemuel. It is not for kings to drink wine, nor for princes intoxicating drink, lest they drink and forget the law and pervert the justice of all the afflicted. Give strong drink to him who is perishing, and wine to those who are bitter of heart. Let him drink and forget his poverty and remember his misery no more. Open your mouth for the speechless, in the cause of all who are appointed to die. Open your mouth, judge righteously, and plead the cause of the poor and needy. Who can find a virtuous wife? For her worth is far above rubies. The heart of her husband safely trusts her, so he will have no lack of gain. She does him good and not evil all the days of her life. She seeks wool and flax and willingly works with her hands. She is like the merchant ships. She brings her food from afar. She also rises while it is yet night and provides food for her household and a portion for her maidservants. She considers a field and buys it. For her profits she plants a vineyard. She girds herself with strength and strengthens her arms. She perceives that her merchandise is good and her lamp does not go out by night. She stretches out her hands to the distaff and her hand holds the spindle. She extends her hand to the poor, yet she reaches out her hands to the needy. She is not afraid of snow for her household, for all her household is clothed with scarlet. She makes tapestry for herself. Her clothing is fine linen and purple. Her husband is known in the gates when he sits among the elders of the land. She makes linen garments and sells them, and supplies sashes for the merchants. Strength and honour are her clothing. She shall rejoice in time to come. She opens her mouth with wisdom, and on her tongue is the law of kindness. She watches over the ways of her household, and does not drink, does not eat the bread of idleness. Her children rise up and call her blessed, her husband also, and he praises her. Many daughters have done well, but you excel them all. Charm is deceitful, and beauty is passing. But a woman who fears the Lord, she shall be praised. Give her of the fruit of her hands, and let her own works praise her in the gates. And may God bless the reading of his holy word. We have here, as I say, two independent compositions. On the one hand, we have the words of King Lemuel, and secondly, we have the wise wife. We may title these sections indeed the wise king and the wise wife. And both of these have a connection with women, because one of them is actually the words of a woman, a mother, and the other words about a woman. Proverbs contains many character studies. But Proverbs, when it speaks of wisdom personified, speaks of wisdom personified as a woman. Now part of that, of course, is to do with grammatical gender. But it does mean that here in this final section we're brought back to this idea of wisdom, the woman teaching. And particularly this idea of teaching in the family. The mother teaches the son. Now, when we look at the first section, the words of King Lemuel, that is, verses 1 through 9. We're first of all struck with the question, who is King Lemuel? Who was he? The short answer is we have no idea. There has been some commentators, some scholars suggest that this is a disguise for King Solomon. But it's really hard to establish that, given that the book of Proverbs uses Solomon's real name. And Lemuel is not actually a Hebrew word. It is Semitic, but it's not Hebrew. The probability is that it's of the same kind of period as chapter 30. That is the period of Job, that patriarchal period. And Lemuel, we don't know where he reigned, but we do know he had a wise mother. The queen mother in the ancient world could be quite an important person. She was there to offer advice to her son. Being an older woman who had brought him up, she was there as somebody who had no political power in the formal sense, and therefore could be an advisor who wouldn't excite the jealousy of the various lords and princes. And here she is giving advice as a mother about two very important things. And she is speaking, as it were, mother knows best here. Mother knows best when she is wise. Mother who has observed things. A mother who is, in some sense, the sort of woman who is spoken of in the second part of this chapter. And again, it's a reminder of this point that, biblically, the parents are the first influence on any child, and home is the first place of education. And she speaks with love for her son. Verse 2, son of my womb, son of my vows, that she has, when he was a little boy, dedicated him to the Lord. She has said, this my son, who most likely, given the context, he would have been the heir to the throne, or one of the heirs, because we don't know what the political setup in King Lemuel's country was. There are some countries where there's an absolute settled succession, like our country. In our country, we know that, all other things being equal, when King Charles dies, he'll be succeeded by his son William, and William will be succeeded by his son George, because the line of succession is the eldest, well, it's now the eldest child, but historically the eldest son, unless there was no son. But in many Oriental countries, the situation was that the king might have many sons, and he would choose which of his sons was to succeed him. And if he died without naming a successor, there might be a civil war. I remember years ago watching a documentary on the end of the Ottoman Empire, and one of the men interviewed for this was one of the Ottoman princes. He said he was very glad that the Ottoman Empire ended, because if it hadn't, he would have been murdered by his older brother. Because the idea was that when the Ottoman Emperor died and he succeeded, then his successor then killed all his brothers, so there would be no other claimants to the throne. Now, obviously, that's the Ottoman Empire. It was a very cruel system. But you have this. We see this, of course, with Absalom, and in particular, among David's sons, these jockeying for who will succeed David, that there is no established line. But Lemuel has been brought up as a prince. He has been vowed that he will serve God. And his mother then gives him this advice. She starts off with, these are the things that a king should not do. And fundamentally, a king is not to be dedicated to his own pleasure. A king is not to be a man given over to pleasure. Last year, during the celebrations for the late Queen's Platinum Jubilee, I visited Grimsthorpe Castle in Lincolnshire. Now, Grimsthorpe Castle, the family who own it, they had a historic role to play in the coronation. And one of the things it meant was that they got various perks as a result, including some of the clothes worn by past monarchs. And among them there was the outfit was worn by King George IV when he was crowned. Now King George IV, he's the Prince Regent, George III's son, and he then crowned. But as the guide in the room pointed out, this is not the one they've got is not the original, because King George wouldn't let them have the original. And the reason for this was that King George was notorious for his high living. And the original, to be honest, George was embarrassed by how big the outfit was, by how fat he'd become. Because he was given over to this wine, women and song lifestyle. It is not for kings to drink wine, and the idea here isn't this, that the king must be a teetotaler, rather it's that the king has to be controlling his appetite. That's again what verse 3 is about, but the king is not to be a man given over to the pleasures of the flesh. The king isn't to say, I am the king, this is my kingdom now, and I can do what I please, I can take what I please, and I can just live a life of luxury. The king is not a man who is given over to a life of luxury. He shouldn't be. It's not for him. Do not give your strength to women. And again, it's as far from being misogynist as possible. The idea here rather is, again, the Oriental setup, the king's harem. That the king can take to himself many, many wives, even as King Solomon, of course. Solomon has his wives, his concubines, and concubines in that context are secondary wives. Their children don't have inheritance rights the way that the wives' children do. But he's not to take to himself many, many women and give himself to the pleasures of the flesh, the ways. Not to give his ways to that which destroys kings, his self-indulgence, the palaces. I mean, one thinks of, for example, the Palace of Versailles, which is absolutely beautiful. But you do ask, hang on a minute, how much did this cost, and what were the social conditions for the common people in France at the time? And of course, this is what contributes to the French Revolution, is this conspicuous consumption by the monarch, while the common people are starving. Now in this country we have a tradition of doing our best to make sure that our monarchs obey these rules, simply by the fact that they're dependent upon Parliament for money. It is not for kings to give themselves to self-indulgence. And of course this applies to anyone in any position of authority. That those in position of authority who give themselves self-indulgence, well, we've seen, of course, Partygate, these scandals to do with just self-indulgence while the people were suffering, while the people were struggling, lest they drink and forget the law and pervert the justice of all the afflicted. The self-centred ruler only thinks about himself. He doesn't think about the common people. He might think about the other upper class people, but he won't think about the ordinary people. And he instead will pervert justice, because a fundamental point in Scripture is government is concerned with justice. This is part of the point of what the Apostle Paul says. He writes to the Romans. Romans chapter 13, that well-known section on the governing authorities, that every soul be subject to the governing authorities. For there is no authority except from God, and the authorities that exist are appointed by God. Therefore, whoever resists the authority resists the ordinance of God, and those who resist will bring judgment on themselves. For rulers are not a terror to good works, but to evil. If you want to be unafraid of the authority, do what is good, and you will have praise from the same. And of course, this is talking about the normal state of things. But he is God's minister to you for good. But if you do evil, be afraid, he does not bear the sword, that is the power of punishment, in vain, for he is God's minister, God's servant, an avenger to execute wrath on him who practices evil. Justice is a central part of what government is there for. It's there to pass just laws, it is there to administer those laws, it is there to make sure that there is justice for everybody. The government is not supposed to look, and we see this in the way that the laws, the civil laws of old Israel were set up. There wasn't one law for the common people and another one for the nobles. And that was very different from Babylon, for example. In Babylon, if a common man killed a noble, off with his head. If a noble killed a common man, well then he must pay a fine. There was one law for nobles. The nobles were treated much differently from the common man. Not in Israel. And so, the king is not to become a tyrant, a man who considers just himself. Anyone in government is not to be a tyrant. And of course this goes all the way down to anyone with any kind of authority at all. Anyone with any kind of authority is to recognise that this authority is to be exercised for the good of those who are under them and not the other way around. And certainly the idea of self-indulgence, anyone with authority who engages in self-indulgence, that is utterly destructive. So what is the king to do? Well, part of this, of course, I've already mentioned, but it's to be just. The king is to be just, and he is to be kind. Verses 6 and 7 are somewhat surprising, I think, to many of us. Give strong drink to him who is perishing, and wine to those who are bitter of heart. Let him drink and forget his poverty, and remember his misery no more. Well, of course, there's an element of hyperbole, of rhetorical exaggeration here. But the point here is that if anyone is going to be drinking alcohol, let it be the suffering. Let it be those who are in pain. Let it be those who are bitter of heart. Not in the sense of getting drunk, but in the sense of enjoying God's good gifts. So that Psalm 104, reading from verse 14, speaking of God's works of providence in creation. He causes the grass to grow for the cattle, and the vegetation for the service of man, that he may bring forth food from the earth, and wine that makes glad the heart of man, oil to make his face shine, and bread which strengthens man's heart. There is this association of wine and joy. And so those who lack joy, give them wine, that they may forget their poverty. And who is being told to do this? It's the king. He's being told, give to those who are in need. Help the poor and needy. The king is to be compassionate. He's to be there for the people. Government is not there to grind the face of the poor, but to bless the poor. If any must drink, says Lendl's mother, let it be the poor and needy, let it be the suffering. As for the king, open your mouth for the speechless. The king is not simply to think in terms of those who have power, but he's to think first of all of those who don't have any power. The speechless, in other words, the orphan and the widow, the people that the nobles can just pass over in and particularly, of course, here in a non-democratic society, it would be so easy just to ignore the poor and needy. Those who have no voice, but instead the king is to be a voice for the voiceless. Those in authority are to take great care of those who are overlooked in the cause of all who are appointed to die. Open your mouth, judge righteously. Again, particularly talking about those in government to, and those in the judicial system, and the king is the final judge, as it were, and all judging is done in his name. And he is to judge righteously, he is to sit upon the throne, and he is to determine the just and the unjust, and plead the cause of the poor and needy. Those who he might be tempted to ignore, those who he can actually, he can look and say, well, I'm not going to actually get any advantage from these people. These are the poor, they're not even the ones paying taxes. But they're my people, and I am to care for them. And so the wise Queen Mother advises, be a good king, a kind and wise and just and gracious king. And then secondly, we deal with the virtuous wife, the wise wife. Now this section, one of the reasons we know it's independent from verses 1 through 9 is that it is an acrostic in the Hebrew. That is to say that successive sections begin with the successive letters of the Hebrew alphabet. There's no such device in the first part of this chapter, so we know the two are independent because they look different. They don't depend on each other. But there's one section and another section that are differently written. And there's a number of concerns and ideas about this section. One of them is the question, well, is this really the ideal wife, or is this wisdom personified? I suspect it's a bit of a mixture. That this idealised wife, because it is idealised, is also a picture of wisdom. We've had wisdom in the early chapters, Proverbs chapter 1, Proverbs chapter 8, personified as a woman. And now we have the idea, perhaps, of marrying wisdom. That a man needs a good wife. And he needs a wise wife. The picture here is that of a wife of a gentleman. Not a nobleman. Not a queen depicted here, but the wife of a gentleman. We know this because, first of all, her husband is known in the gates. Now, the gates here, this is to do with, he's a member of the town council. He's on the council, he's not one of the nobility. Nobility are separate from the town council. He is one of the elders of the land. He's somebody who is involved as a merchant. She's doing merchant things. He's a gentleman merchant. And she is a perfect companion to him. The first thing we notice about her character, having said a little bit about her identity, is this, that she and her husband are a team. They work together. They're not in opposition to each other. They're not butting heads. He isn't a hindrance to her, and she is not a hindrance to him. In fact, he is able, verse 23, he is able to be on the town council. Partly because she's there to support him. We have a proverb of our own, that behind every great man there is a woman. Every great man, and of course like all proverbs, it's a generalisation, but you look at the great men in history and you can see that by and large they have had great supportive wives. And they wouldn't have been able to do one half of what they did if it hadn't been for the wives there in the background. And of course, the wife isn't noticed very much. She's doing what she does at home. But her character, her relationship with her husband is they are a team. They work together. Well, the obvious team that we find that comes to mind in the Bible is Priscilla and Aquila. It's always notable that, for the most part, when they're mentioned, it's always Priscilla and Aquila, not Aquila and Priscilla. As if she is regarded by Luke as the more notable of the pair. But they, together, they're a team. You can't have just Aquila. You can't have just Priscilla. You've got to have Priscilla and Aquila. But when Apollos needs his support, he needs his teaching, his guidance, he can't have just one of them. It's got to be both of them are helping. And that's the ideal here, the ideal that's set forth here. Who can find a virtuous wife? And of course it's seeking two young men in particular here. For her worth is far above rubies. The heart of her husband safely trusts her. He has no concerns. He doesn't say, well, I've got to be careful what I allow my wife to have. Reading the way some of Arnold Bennett's short stories, his £5 stories, and one of them about a couple where the husband is always rationing out the money to his wife because he's never quite sure what she'll buy with it. And of course many of the stories have to do with the things that she buys that are often quite ridiculous, going into a department store. Of course, fictionalised family, and oh, here's this table, I must have this table. Of course, it's all quite comedic. But this wife is not like that. He safely trusts her, so he will have no lack of gain. He knows he's not the one who's making the money just so she can spend it, but rather they together are cooperating. She does him good and not evil all the days of her life. She's always there for him. She's always there supporting him. She's there. She is helping to make his life easier, and he is making hers easier because they trust each other. They have this wonderful relationship of trust. And because it's a partnership, she is neither a drudge just doing whatever he tells her, nor is she some ornament who is really quite useless, although quite pretty. Instead, she has her things that she's doing. She seeks wool and flax. She goes out to the market, she does the shopping, or she does her shopping. And she's always finding something. She's like the merchant ships. She brings her food from afar. It's a wonderful picture here. There you are, the docks. And the merchant ships have come from Tarshish and are unloading their goods. But when she comes home from the market and she's unloading the bags, her husband's always amazed there's something there that she's found. Just a special treat, perhaps. Something there that they can enjoy together. And she's interested in his work, his business, and in the family business. She goes to the field and buys it. She's thinking in terms of, and again, this picture here, of course, is the wife of a merchant. He's interested in acquiring land, buying and selling. She is making things, verse 19, stretching out her hands. The distaff and her hand holds the spindle, so she's spinning thread. And she's generous, she's gracious, she extends her hand to the poor, yet she reaches out her hands to the needy. She cares. And she opens her mouth with wisdom, verse 26, and on her tongue is a law of kindness. Wisdom and kindness are joined together in her character. She is wise. She considers things. She thinks through things. And of course, wisdom in Proverbs fundamentally begins with what it begins with, the fear of the Lord. Verse 30, a woman who fears the Lord, that is, has that true and perfect wisdom, she shall be praised. It's that reverence that everything she does comes from this. Indeed, worldly people have their foolish ideas. Charm is deceitful and beauty is passing. Worldly people think only in terms of the outward. A worldly man is looking just for a pretty wife who looks good. And he doesn't consider her heart, he doesn't consider her character, he doesn't consider that her charm may be hiding something, and doesn't think, well, of course, hang on a minute, if we're married, we're going to get old together, we should get old together. And if all there is beauty, then very soon he will be disappointed, and she'll be disappointed as well. But she fears the Lord. That beauty of character has its root, that true reverence, that true love for God, that piety. But that phrase in the Old Testament, the fear of the Lord, sums up piety. She loves God. And that's the root of this beautiful marriage that we have pictured here, this beautiful relationship of the husband and wife. Now, of course, most people are not of the gentry class. Most people are not going to be in a situation where anyone's going to be on the council anytime soon. But everyone can think in terms of wisdom and the fear of the Lord. Many daughters have done well, the husband says. Now there are many women who have done good things. There are many good women out there, but he says you excel them all. He's in love with her. He loves his wife because she loves the Lord, and they together then are this team cooperating, this team where she is wise and he is wise. He's known in the gates when he sits among the elders of the land. Their wisdom builds each other up. And so we're brought back at the end, verse 30, to that same subject that Proverbs begins with, Proverbs 1, 7, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. The fear of the Lord. The whole book can be summed up really in that. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. That true reverence is true wisdom. Because we live in God's world. Through kings, through gentry, all the way down, everybody needs that wisdom. And that wisdom can only be found in true reverence for God. And we can only really possess that wisdom if we possess Christ. For Christ is named to us wisdom from God. In him, the divine wisdom dwells. And so as we conclude the book of Proverbs, we are left again with this thought of the wisdom of God and the fear of God. And we give thanks that God has sent his Son. And we know him. And we are in him. And he in us. Oh, may the Lord grant us ever his wisdom. Amen.